Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest today, Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Blumenthal's book has gotten little mainstream attention. The closest is a series of raving denunciations from his Nation colleague, Eric Alterman. More on all that in a moment. I've got a little extra time today for some comments on the economic news. Alas, this show is being broadcast just before the U.S. employment report for October comes out. It's going to be a hard one to read because of all the oddities surrounding the government's shutdown, both its effects on the job market itself and on the data collection by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. My guess is that we'll see more of the same, a stumbling recovery that's better than recession, but still not enough to make a serious dent in unemployment or give a serious boost to average incomes. It's now more than 5 years since the Lehman Brothers collapse, more than seven since the housing bubble started leaking, and more than four since the Great Recession officially ended. But things remain very sick, and all we have in the mainstream is talk about the best form that austerity can take. A lot of people across the country and even abroad have taken the landslide election of Bill de Blasio as mayor of New York as some sign of leftward turn in our politics. Much was made of de Blasio's past support of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, which, don't get me wrong, was a good thing. But right after the election, de Blasio announced the leadership of his transition team. The co-chairs are quite interesting. The less provocative one is Jennifer Jones Austin. Jones Austin is the head of the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies, a classic elite do-good nonprofit that emerged out of early 20th century efforts of the upper classes to rescue the poor. They do some good work, no doubt, but institutions led by CEOs paid $300,000 a year are not real avatars of transformative politics. Curiously, Jones Austin is a former VP at Edison Schools, which has long been a promoter of vouchers and charters. Interesting, given de Blasio's criticism of charter schools during the campaign. But Wall Street loves them, so you gotta wonder. And speaking of Wall Street, the more provocative co-chair is a guy named Carl Weisbrot. Weisbrot has a long resume in the real estate city planning machine. He ran Times Square 42nd Street redevelopment, which led to the Disneyfication of the area, headed the Economic Development Corporation, an opaque state-chartered body that does a great deal of city planning work, largely behind closed doors, with the power to condemn and subsidize. Its current major projects include the redevelopment of downtown Brooklyn, meaning bringing in upscale retail and luxury high-rise condos. Weisbrot ran Trinity Church's real estate division for a while. It's huge. They're one of the largest landowners in Manhattan and were notoriously hostile, though sometimes furtively so, to Occupy Wall Street. And Weisbrot founded the Alliance for Downtown New York, a real estate front organization. Weisbrot is an embodiment of the forces that run New York City over the long term, the so-called FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate. The status quo must be very relieved by this appointment. While de Blasio's victory might suggest that voters are sick of being governed by and for billionaires, I'm skeptical it portends a major shift in policy. My only guest today is Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, just out from Nation Books. Goliath is a richly detailed account of life in that country, the growing repression of the Palestinian population, both in the occupied territories and within Israel proper, and the brutalizing effects on the broad population of running what looks more and more like an apartheid state. Blumenthal writes not only about big-picture political stuff, the army, the courts, Knesset, cabinet ministers, but also about how it feels to live in that society, especially if you have anything like a critique of the mainstream. As I said at the beginning of the show, Blumenthal's book has gotten little attention in the big media. The closest it's come to that has been an amazing set of denunciations from Blumenthal's Nation colleague, the columnist Eric Alterman, including the charming observation that the book could have been published by the Hamas Book of the Month Club. That bit of lazy hackery could have come out of the official Israeli PR machine. It's a slur, not an actual critique. Alterman also says Blumenthal's accounts are mostly technically accurate, but often deliberately deceptive, whatever that means, and then goes on to offer next to nothing by way of evidence. I suspect what Alterman really means is that polite critiques are okay, but a sustained systemic dissection is not. He knows what Blumenthal said is true, he just doesn't want to draw the conclusions that there's something deeply structurally wrong with Israel. Blumenthal attracted a lot of attention with a video he shot in 2009 of drunk Jewish American youth vacationing in Tel Aviv, saying hideously racist things about Barack Obama and Arabs. YouTube and Vimeo both banned it as violating their terms of service. Although there's been some loosening of the strictures and debate about Israel and the U.S., there are still some limits you can't cross, and Blumenthal crosses them. His earlier book, Republican Gomorrah, published in 2009, was an examination of the Christian right. While important, that sort of thing plays well in the liberal media, even drawing the praise of Hendrik Hertzberg of The New Yorker. Not this book. I should say that I was only able to get Max on a cell phone. It's getting harder all the time to get people on landlines, and while the audio quality of this one is pretty good, it's still not quite as good as a landline, nor as good as Skype would be, if you overlook the occasional dropouts and garbling. Believe me, I try to get the best connection I can, but sometimes the best is unattainable. Okay, here's Max Blumenthal. Welcome, Max. I certainly am not unfamiliar with events in Israel. Never been there, but I certainly read about it a lot and talk about it a lot. Your portrait of the country is something far grimmer than I even could have imagined. Did it just strike you that way? Were you surprised and just how terrible things were?
It's possible to go on a tour through Israel with as I did on the Birthright Israel tour when I was 22, and actually not see any of the racism or violence or what many Israelis consider to be fascist displays. But when you actually immerse yourself in the society and immerse yourself in the everyday lives of Jewish Israelis, especially young dissident Jewish Israelis, becomes impossible to ignore. And you see how it impacts their lives and corrodes the social fabric. If anything surprised me, it was the extent to which these, especially young Jewish Israelis, had either immunized themselves or inured themselves against the racism and violence just to go on with their everyday lives, and the degree to which other young Jewish Israelis, who represent really the majority in the mainstream and the future of Israel, were so open about expressing racism and their desire to participate in the violence of and the, just the everyday task of occupying, dominating, and controlling Palestinians.
What was your research? I mean, to describe how much time you spent and where you spent it.
Well, I got the deal to do this book in 2009, right after Israel elected the most right-wing government in its history. And I'd been following this issue, as you had, throughout our adult lives. But through about 4 or 5 years of intense research and writing, and about 1 year on the ground, mostly behind the Green Line, but also spending extended time in the West Bank. I was just in Ramallah in September for several weeks. I was able to really get at least the broad outlines of Israel-Palestine and Israeli society, and to be able to immerse myself in the environment and key institutions like the Knesset, and really return with this portrait, which many people consider to be a terrible vision, but it's a vision of a future it's a warning about a future that I think will be much more terrible than anything we can imagine right now if the status quo persists.
Well, the present seems bad enough, but we'll leave that aside. How are you greeted as a Jewish American? Is it insider, an outsider, under suspicion, welcomed? What was the reaction?
Interestingly, as a Jewish American, I was able to gain access to places and people that other Americans, non-Jews, and especially an Arab American would not be able to do. So this book is really the product of my Jewish privilege being played out under a regime of apartheid that privileges me over all others. And, when I requested interviews with members of the Israeli Knesset, I profile more than a handful, maybe a score of Israeli Knesset members who are behind this anti-democratic agenda of introducing new bills each week to strip Palestinian citizens of their rights inside Israel, they were very open to me and were willing to hold very straightforward discussions with me about their agenda and what they intended to do. One of them, David Rotem from Avigdor Lieberman's Yisrael Beiteinu party, who is the author or co-sponsor of so many of these anti-democratic bills, hosted me at his settlement home in Efrat. And he told me, he looked into my eye and he told me, the tyranny of the majority is the essence of democracy. So while I completely disagreed with him, I really welcomed his refreshing straightforwardness. And this is something you get from right-wingers in Israel. They're very straightforward and proud of their agenda, and they're happy to talk to me about it.
Okay, let's do some history. I mean, there is a myth, I think Noam Chomsky has mocked as the beautiful Israel myth, going way back, that the country may have gone wrong in recent years, but there were beauty and ideals at the founding. What's your reaction to that?
Well, as you know, liberal American Jews are consistently deceived into believing that there is a faction of Israelis who are just like them. They're the beautiful Israel, and they want that they share the same vision for Israel as they do, the Peter Beinart vision of a democratic Israel with equal rights for all and an independent Palestinian state, so they can continue holding on to this fantasy of a good Jewish state. The fact is that that Israel doesn't exist and has never existed. And my book, you know, really puts the lie to that with my portrayal of the kibbutz movement as socialism for Jews only. Organizing economic boycotts of businesses that employed Arabs, and that plays directly into the hands of the extreme right-wing anti-miscegenation movement, which is burgeoning in Israel today, and is handing out kosher certificates to businesses that refuse to employ Arabs. This was a tactic first employed by the labor Zionist movement, which liberal American Jews are taught to revere, and you know it's challenged with my interaction with David Grossman, the Israeli author who is lionized by many liberal American Jews who believe in the beautiful Israel. He is really the voice of the beautiful Israel. And when I challenged Grossman on this idea of why we still need Zionism and why we still need an exclusivist Jewish state, he reverted to the same mythology that Benjamin Netanyahu relies on, that we've been kept out for thousands of years, and this allows us to be insiders against the will of Palestinians. And I said, well, my father was an insider. He worked in the Clinton administration. We're living in a golden age in the United States. Why do we need this exclusivist state? And he responded with nothing. This quintessential man of words had absolutely nothing to say to that. And that really told me... It really exposed the extent of what the beautiful Israel was, which is sort of a project to gentrify or beautify the real Israel, which is institutionally racist and founded on a system of open apartheid.
I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, just out from Nation Books. Yeah, I mean, the founding idea of the state, a state of Jews, how often is that interrogated? That is a remarkable thing.
I mean, yeah, or a Jewish and democratic state, how do you maintain that? It's not just a conflict that, there's not just a tension between the Jewish character and the democratic charter of the state. It's a fundamental conflict, especially when you're trying to apply that kind of system in a place where indigenous people live by the hundreds of thousands. It requires ethnic cleansing continuously. And it's not just, you know, liberal American Jews who are agonizing over this fundamental conflict. It's Israelis themselves, and they want to relieve themselves of the conflict. So I write in my book about a bill that's been introduced in the last Knesset, and it's being reintroduced in the current Knesset by the third most popular politician in Israel, Naftali Bennett, who's a rising star in Israeli politics. And it's a bill to define officially Israel's Jewish character as superior to its democratic charter, and basically bring apartheid out into the open. It's of a part with all the legislation that the right wing and the governing parties are introducing to basically just end the lie and choose a democratic state, a Jewish state, over a democratic one. And I fully support that. because I support them at least exposing what this state has always been since its foundation.
But of course, now the displacements, the cleansings, the house destructions, the massacres go back to the foundational moment.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the labor Zionist movement and what, you know, is now the Zionist left, which was responsible for the Nakba and responsible for the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The right wing has the dynamism and the strong identity to persevere and continue this project forward. You know, I always think about 1967 and this seminal episode when Yigal Alon, who was a Haganah commander, a hero of the kibbutz movement, one of Yitzhak Rabin's right-hand men, a man of the Zionist left who had basically carried out the ethnic cleansing of Lida. And in 1967, he was sent as a government minister to Hebron when Moshe Levinger, the right-wing extremist rabbi, had taken over a hotel room. He'd rented a hotel room out with the intention of basically establishing a settlement in Hebron. And Alon's job was to remove Levinger, but instead of removing him, he shook his hand and thanked him for what he's doing, because in the settlers, the Gush Emunim, the religious settlers, Alon saw himself and the early, what he believed were the early Zionist pioneers. So this energy of messianism has been in Zionism from the beginning, whether it's secular messianism or religious nationalist messianism. And we've seen the baton handed off from the labor Zionist movement to religious nationalism. They're defining the identity and the future of Israel, and it's not going to go back. And this is the crisis for liberal American Jews, is that Israelis, especially young Israelis, have a completely different vision than they do, and it's a explicitly anti-democratic, ethnocratic vision defined along the lines of a rearmed Jewish identity, which is bigoted and bellicose. And we'll continue to see these rifts between American Jews and Israel as long as this continues. What I did with my book, you know, I don't write about the domestic Jewish situation in the U.S. I don't touch on that. I just show people, especially Americans, what they're paying for and what the real Israel is and will be.
Now, those settlers, I mean, the Gush Emunim were the early instance of them. I think they're sometimes taken as kind of out of control nutcases, but really they're at the core of a political strategy, aren't they?
Definitely. I mean, they have a clear strategy for building Israel out and settling according to a blueprint that was drawn up in the Oslo Accords, settling the West Bank and confining the Palestinians to a limited space, to basically three or four population centers, and creating enough pressure on the government to make sure that this plan is fulfilled. It basically has been fulfilled, and so where my book comes in is through the settlement movement Settling in the Hearts plan, which is to actually move back from the West Bank, since they've already dominated the space there, into core Israeli cities. And I write about living in Jaffa, which is the Palestinian ghetto of Tel Aviv, where settlers from the West Bank have just built a yeshiva, or a Jewish school of learning, and they're using the yeshiva as a base to stage basically intimidating marches throughout the neighborhood, demanding that the Palestinians leave, chanting Jaffa for Jews. They firebombed my favorite restaurant in the neighborhood. They vandalized a Muslim cemetery. They've invaded Palestinian homes and menaced people at mosques. And there's a campaign in the neighborhood being waged by a new gated community that was built there, much like a settlement, to shut down the call of the muezzin from local mosques and stop the tolling of the bells from this Christian church, which was built well before the foundation of the State of Israel. So you actually see a kind of settlement project in core Israeli cities, in Tel Aviv and Acre, and you see these initiatives in Haifa to create pressure on the Palestinian citizens in this city to leave. It's what Oren Yiftahel, the Israeli academic, calls vertical apartheid. His idea is that horizontal apartheid was the effort to expand the settler colonial enterprise into the West Bank. Now that that's done and completed, everything is being built upwards and returning to Israel proper, to the home of, you know, to the liberal secular bubble of Tel Aviv.
That was the first part of an interview with Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, just out from Nation Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Krzysztof Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, with the composer conducting the Polish National Radio Symphony Orchestra. Now on to part two of my interview with the journalist Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, just out from Nation Books. Let's talk some about the Israeli Arabs. It's about, what, 20% of the population? Describe what life is like for them.
Well, 20% of Israel's population are Palestinian citizens of Israel who identify with the broader Palestinian world and with the Arab world, in contrast to Israeli Jews who tend to identify with Europe and orient themselves towards Europe. So there's a fundamental cultural conflict, but Palestinian citizens of Israel lived under military rule from 1948 to 1966, which was the blueprint for the occupation. They are maybe not even second-class citizens. You might even call them third-class citizens. They are subject to a different set of rules, specifically on building their houses. In Jaffa, there are 500 standing eviction orders, all Palestinian homes, because you pretty much can't get a permit to renovate or build your home if you are a Palestinian citizen of Israel. Israel fears their natural growth because it's trying to engineer a Jewish demographic majority, so it tries to limit them from building within their own towns. And it has not allowed the establishment of a new Arab town inside Israel since Israel was founded. But now with the election of this right-wing government and the permanent right-wing majority, we see an effort to actually strip Palestinian citizens of Israel of their citizenship rights. This was the slogan of Avigdor Lieberman's campaign in 2009, no loyalty, no citizenship. And there's an effort to ban them from running for Knesset elections and to actively remove the Bedouin in the Negev, who are citizens of Israel who often serve in the Israeli army, to actually remove them from their homes and put them on Indian reservation-style communities, which, according to the administrators of these communities, are built to, quote-unquote, concentrate the Bedouin. It's called the Praver Plan, P-R-A-W-E-R. Your listeners can look it up. And it's a plan to ethnically cleanse 40,000 Bedouins from communities that are already the state refuses to recognize and force them into what amounts to Indian reservations and replace them with Jewish-only towns. This will be the largest project of ethnic cleansing since 1948, and the American media, to my knowledge, has not reported on it at all.
I did notice that maybe one or two of the Israelis you spoke with turned it back on you and said, well, look what you did to the Indians, and they do have a point.
They do have a point, and, you know, the United States was not able to democratize or liberalize until it completed the genocide of Native Americans. And Israel will not be able to democratize or liberalize until either it is an ethnically pure state or Palestinian resistance has basically been completely crushed or Palestinians have been expelled totally, or it becomes a solution is imposed on it, whereby it becomes a full democracy with equal rights for everyone. And, of course, Israel's biggest problem is efforts to impose democracy on it from the outside. As a journalist, you know, I see the American experience, and I ask myself, what would I have done during the 19th century? during the Indian Wars, during the efforts to crush the final vestiges of Lakota Sioux resistance. And I think I would have liked to have been in the American West reporting on this, providing the primary documents that maybe D. Brown would have used later in his work. And that's kind of what I see myself doing in Israel-Palestine, I think. It's an emergency situation. We're witnessing ethnic cleansing before our eyes, and it needed to be exposed. So that's one of the things that I aim to do with my book.
The people of Israel, though, the Jews, the majority of the population, what is the state of their awareness of what's going on? Is it something that they're aware of and don't want to think about? It's something they cheer on? Is it something they think this is necessary and we regret it? I mean, what is the attitude and knowledge about what's going on?
That is a great question. Now, I think the settlers understand what's going on, and the right-wingers understand what's going on, and they're happy about it. They're the happy people. And you really feel that they're happy when you see them dancing and parading on Israeli Independence Day through the heart of Tel Aviv. You'll meet in my book this ragtag band of Israeli Jewish human rights activists who are leveling their body against the occupation. And these, I have to say, they're not the happiest bunch of people because they're facing increasing repression and castigation in their own society. But they also happen to be some of the bravest people I've ever met. And where they feel the most marginalized is not within broader Israeli society. It's within Tel Aviv, because most young Tel Avivians are connected, you know, the secular middle class and upper middle class who are highly educated. Are more connected to the global high-tech economy. And for them, Palestine is more far away than Kathmandu or Goa, India, where they frequently vacation. Palestinians are tucked behind an iron wall. They're under siege in the Gaza Strip, and they're unseen in Tel Aviv. Palestinian resistance is right now at one of the lowest ebbs in history. And it's only through the BDS movement and the cultural boycott, where performers are asked not to perform in Tel Aviv, the new sun city, that these liberal, secular Tel Aviv middle-class young people actually can hear about Palestinians or recognize their presence. And I think that's one of the greatest problems, or one of the biggest reasons for the deepening of the Israel-Palestine crisis, is the deliberate and studied apathy of the liberal class in Tel Aviv.
The apologists for Israel will say that it is a democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, as I like to say, but for the 80% of the population that's Jewish. But it, from your reporting, it seems even less and less true of that majority population. The encroachments upon democracy and free expression are remarkable, persistent, and worsening.
It's never been a democracy. If it has been, it besmirches the concept of democracy. The Israeli Supreme Court ruled last month that there was no such thing as an Israeli nationality. In other words, nationality could only be classified according to ethnicity, Jewish or Arab, which is the basis of apartheid. So for Jews, it is a democracy. It's a Jewish and democratic state. It's democratic to Jews, but it's Jewish to Arabs. And that's why, if you ask Palestinian citizens of Israel, they're increasingly pessimistic about being integrated into Israeli society as equal citizens. You can look at the opinion polls during the Oslo era and opinion polls now of Palestinian citizens, and they just are absolutely pessimistic. And it has to do with the demands being placed on them to declare either that they will become Zionists and loyal second-class citizens or leave. These demands have been placed on them through the passage of a new law requiring that all new citizens of Israel swear loyalty to the Jewish and democratic state, and proposed laws demanding that anyone who wants an Israeli ID or driver's license take a loyalty oath. A new law called the Acceptance to Communities Act, allowing communities of under 500 to discriminate on the basis of race or religion to keep Palestinians out. The Shin Bet's attack, the General Security Service of Israel's attack on Palestinian-Israeli civil society, is rampant, and their leadership has been increasingly jailed or harassed. It's something I write about extensively in my book. And so, you know, I actually spent some time with some young Palestinian citizens of Israel who are not particularly political, who are not activists. They actually worked in the Israeli tech sector. And they told me that even there, at the top of Palestinian-Israeli society, they're on their way to vacation in Switzerland. You know, they're very educated and well off, that they even feel like, you know, under increasing pressure to leave. One of them told me, sometimes I'm so sick of being an Arab, I just want to be a guy. And that's a depressing attitude that I increasingly heard from the minority sector in Israel.
I'm speaking with Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath from Nation Books. But it also seems there have been substantial repression of even free expression, the right to demonstrate, among Jews.
Well, there's a fascinating video on Israel, on Israeli Independence Day 2012, that I wrote about. It was shot by Leah Tarachansky, who's an Israeli colleague of mine, who's grew up in a settlement and has really become one of the major dissident voices in Israel and one of the best critical reporters on the situation. And she shows a group called Zokrot, which means memory. It's an Israeli Jewish group dedicated to observing the Nakba, or the Palestinian mass dispossession in 1948. And on Israeli Independence Day, in the middle of Tel Aviv, when Israelis are celebrating the foundation of this state with fireworks and marches, they come out and they read out the names of destroyed Palestinian villages. And you see them being besieged by border police officers, mobs forming to attack them, and they're basically arrested one by one for reading out the names of these villages. This perfectly symbolizes the kind of atmosphere for dissident Israelis who simply want to make a symbolic observance of 1948. They are under threat because the legacy of 48, not 67, is what haunts Israel today. It's the fear of democracy, the fear of a right of return of refugees that terrorizes the conscience of the mainstream of Jewish Israeli society. And that's something that really forms the narrative foundation for my book.
To bring up a word that makes people very nervous, but seems quite relevant, the sense of a creeping fascism in Israel. I think you recounted a conversation with Leah Tarachansky where she said it's not, you know, the political repression so much as it's this day-to-day feeling that you can't talk freely, that you're going to be attacked for anything you might say. Is that the conversation on the bus you had with her?
Yeah, and Eric Alterman got upset with this conversation, where a young Jewish Israeli who grew up in a settlement, who has turned against the Zionist narrative, was expressing herself about what life is like. And she said it's not just the anti-democratic laws or having her friends be interrogated for questioning the occupation. It's not just seeing Arabs thrown off a bus for speaking Arabic. It's just a mood that you feel. It's what it's like every day. And, you know, I have to admit that I did feel that when I was there, feeling that I couldn't express myself freely and that I had to watch myself everywhere I went, that I was being constantly monitored, and that I was not really welcome because of the way that I thought. I can't really define fascism in a clear way. So in some senses, it's an empty signifier. But for Jewish Israelis, it signifies dark resonances of Jewish history in Europe and the early stages of repression against Jews, seeing it repeated against Palestinians and against Jews who question the Jewish state. I think that's really their frame of reference based on how they're educated. And I have seen Arabs be thrown off buses in Tel Aviv simply for speaking Arabic and detained by the police. I have been randomly detained at the central bus station in Tel Aviv and had all my papers checked just for reasons I didn't understand. An apartment I stayed in Jerusalem right before I moved in had been raided by an immigration unit seeking an activist who was protesting along with Palestinians in the West Bank. These kind of things are everyday occurrences. All my roommates have been to jail for one reason or another. One, because she dressed up like a clown, but like a to mock Israeli border police and was basically arrested for blowing bubbles. You know, so it's not just the violence and the rubber bullets and the white phosphorus falling on the Gaza Strip. It's these everyday the everyday occurrences that really that gradually fail to shock you and lead you to conclude that this environment is something different than a democratic open society. It's as Israeli Justice Eliakim Rubinstein said, Israel is a normal society, a normal country that is not normal. And the abnormalities are outlined in my book and exposed, and I'm able to detach myself as an American so that I don't become immune to them. But what Leah was commenting on, I think, and where she was going with her comment, is that you risk becoming immunized to the point where you accept the environment, and that, to some degree, provides a recipe for fascism to pass.
That was part two of my interview with Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, A Portrait of Life in and Around Israel, just out from Nation Books. Time for another musical break. Another excerpt from Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, with the composer conducting the Polish Radio National Symphony Orchestra. Now the concluding part of my interview with the journalist Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, just out from Nation Books. What was the effect of the influx of, what is it, about 1 million Russians who came into Israel after the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, Israel demanded that after the fall of the Soviet Union, Russian Jews immigrate. They were enticed through the Jewish Agency. Many of them were not technically Jewish, according to the state-sanctioned corps of rabbis, because their mothers may not have been Jewish. But they were basically dumped in these development towns in Israel, faced discrimination and antagonism from veteran Jewish Israelis. And they gradually began to transform Israeli politics. Many of them had little regard for Palestinians and may not have even known they were there, didn't come from a democratic culture, came from a culture of the strong man, where the rhetoric of siege and trenches has enormous currency, and they come to a new place where siege mentality is being cultivated. And so we see these polls of young Russian Israelis, like a 2009 poll I cite, where 78% say they prefer a strong leader to democracy. And that's embodied in Avigdor Lieberman, who is the leader of the Yisrael Beiteinu party. He's going on trial, or actually his verdict is coming up, I think today, for his ties to the mafia. But he is still currently the foreign minister of Israel, Israel's top diplomat. And in embodying the will of the Russian-Israeli public, he has called for stripping Palestinian citizens of their rights and building on the concept of an ethnically pure Jewish state. Many people have described him as a fascist, and maybe that's an accurate designation. But he's also building on efforts in other parties to do the same. So, the Russians are often attacked and demonized as culturally retrograde and politically problematic by liberal Israelis. But it's those same liberal Jewish Israelis who required the Russians to build their demographic edge over the Palestinians. So we have to look at the overall logic of the Jewish state before we blame the Russians for what many consider to be the fascistization of the state.
The Russians were imported as a way of helping defuse what they call the demographic bomb, right?
Exactly.
Now let's talk about the current prime minister, Netanyahu.
You interviewed one young American tourist who thought his name was Yahoo, which was telling and appropriate. But what's his background? He is a very American, right?
Yeah, there was a new poll in Globes, the Israeli publication, which showed that there's really no alternative to Netanyahu or the Likud party right now. He has no rival or clear challenger, so he's a dominant figure. But his background is in the United States, not Israel, which kind of highlights, by the way, the American role in sustaining the occupation and the status quo. But Netanyahu is a graduate of MIT. He worked at Boston Consulting with Mitt Romney. He speaks perfect English. He was raised in suburban Philadelphia. His father died in New York. And Israelis recognize this because they recognize that their strategic deterrence is contingent on their direct line to Washington, and that Netanyahu is the best explainer of Israel's position to the American public. We saw that play out pretty well when Netanyahu spoke before the U.S. Congress and got more standing ovations than Barack Obama, but it wasn't Netanyahu's rhetorical talent as much as AIPAC's grip on Congress that enabled that. Netanyahu's flailing right now with respect to his relationship with the U.S. because of the rapprochement between Obama and Iran. But in Israel, he's a dominant figure who occupies the hollow center of Israeli politics. Part of it has to do with the phenomenon I described before, where the liberal Israeli public in Tel Aviv has kind of turned away from the two-state solution and the peace process, and is looking inward and kind of lets Netanyahu get away with whatever he wants. And the other factor is that inside Netanyahu's own Likud party is a new generation of hardliners who are to the right even of Avigdor Lieberman, who favor annexing most of the West Bank and bringing apartheid out into the open, something Netanyahu has been able to contain. They're like, one of them is Sipi Hotaveli, who is the Sarah Palin of Israel. She's 34 years old. She's very telegenic. She speaks good English. She favors annexing much of the West Bank. And in the last Knesset, she held hearings on the dangers of assimilation or Jewish-Arab relationships and brought members of Israel's anti-miscegenation movement to testify before the Knesset. She is now the deputy transportation minister and is part of this rising crowd of young Turks who are the future of the Likud party and the future of Israeli politics.
It appears that there's like virtually no left or any kind of organized opposition to the repressive trend.
There's no possibility for any internal opposition that can challenge the trends that I'm describing without massive, massive external pressure from things like the BDS movement. The BDS movement and with grassroots civil society efforts at external pressure, that's really the only way that a settler colonial society can be convinced that there's a price for occupying millions of people. The indoctrination inside Jewish Israeli society, and I discuss this at length in my book, Profiling the Education System, is just too intense. The pressure to perform military service is too intense. Social conformism is too comprehensive for Jewish Israelis to organize on their own. I mean, you have a group of really brave dissidents who I also profile in the book and spend a lot of time with, but they number about 700 or 1,000 in this entire society. So the trends will continue unless there's an effort from the outside to push Israel to elect an Israeli de klerk who will bring to an end the system of apartheid.
I want to return to the BDS thing in a moment, but the role of the Holocaust in the Israeli imagination, the collective mind, it seems very vivid, and like they're always just one repressive move away from a rerun of the Holocaust, right? It's just that is the dominant narrative?
That's the narrative of Netanyahu, and Netanyahu really embodies in a sincere way the mood and psychology of, a majority of Jewish Israelis.
You report very interesting contrast in exposure to the sites of the Holocaust in Europe. Like young people who go come back, you know, even more firmly in support of the regime. But when the army experimented with sending people there, it had perverse results, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me about that. I mean, you hit on a really key section of the book, which is about the uses of the Holocaust in Israeli society. And I write about how increasingly the Holocaust is being used to shape Jewish identity and to create political space and psychologically enable young people to participate in the occupation. So 25% of Jewish Israeli high schoolers have been on the March of the Living. They go at age 17, 1 year before they embark on military service. And they march in Auschwitz at the site of Jewish mass slaughter alongside uniformed Israeli military personnel and police. They enter this skepticism about what might happen in the West Bank to them and what they might participate in. And they leave with a heightened sense of nationalism, according to polls on their attitudes by the Israeli Ministry of Education. This is achieved through things like candlelit ceremonies in gas chambers, where they're asked to take on the persona of Jewish children. And, you know, the documentary Defamation by Yoav Shamir shows these kids breaking down in tears in these ceremonies and then declaring that they want to kill Nazis. But when they're made aware of the fact that the Nazis are dead, they say, but the Nazis have heirs, and those are the Palestinians. That's how Netanyahu speaks, and that is part of the educational curricula. But then, as you mentioned, there was a group of Israeli officers who had led frontline units in the West Bank, and they were taken on tours of Auschwitz, government-sponsored tours. And they had the opposite reaction of these young people. Their nationalist attitudes absolutely collapsed, and they developed extremely negative views of the army, the most respected institution in Israeli life. And you can only speculate on why. The researchers who polled them on their attitudes were completely mystified at the results of these polls, but it's pretty clear that they began to see themselves in a different way through this tour, and they began to see the Jews of Auschwitz in light of the Palestinian experience, that they had been involved in dominating and controlling this ethnic outclass, which was demonized and confined to ghettos behind walls and discriminated against on an institutional basis. So I found this to be fascinating. There's another fascinating study by a political psychologist named Daniel Bartal, who found that Israelis who have less experience with the Holocaust, in other words, they don't have a relative who went through the Holocaust, and they themselves didn't experience the Holocaust, are more susceptible to the segregationist view of the Holocaust and are able to accept this kind of indoctrination process, which uses the lessons of the Holocaust to promote militarism and kind of tribalistic worldview.
And then finally, let's talk some about the BDS movement. I always thought it was a little odd for Americans to support it, given the role of our government in arming and funding Israel. I think we should be boycotting ourselves in some sense. But I have a friend who argues that Israeli society is at risk of becoming thoroughly shut off from the outside world, and further isolating it would only be counterproductive. What do you think of that argument?
Well, they're not isolated. They're able to enjoy a first world lifestyle while confining Palestinians to a fifth world lifestyle and actually their economy is benefiting enormously from the occupation, especially through the development of advanced private security technology by using the Palestinians basically as lab rats. All of their weapons and their private security technology is being exported to the world as field tested. This means that they're able to demonstrate it on the Palestinians first. Very few militaries have the kind of luxury that Israelis have, 65 years of experience of dominating and controlling an indigenous people. And meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, you can still attend first-rate concerts and ballets and art museums and pretend that everything is normal. So if there isn't a price tag for controlling and dominating millions of people and excluding millions more, this will continue. All of the trends I've described will continue, and the corrosion of Jewish-Israeli society and the moral collapse of world Jewry will deepen. So this is really, this idea that the more that Israelis feel isolated, the more right-wing they'll turn, is it's ridiculous, and it's also discredited by history. I mean, you look at the history of other settler colonial movements, which agreed to stop discriminating against the indigenous people. South Africa is a perfect example. It was their sense of isolation that enabled de Klerk to negotiate the end of apartheid. And it'll be the same with Israel. I believe it will have to happen. It will have to happen, or unimaginable horrors become inevitable.
Well, because it's not going to happen spontaneously from within Israeli society.
There's no historical precedent for that, and we see where Israeli society is going. More hardline attitudes and more support for permanent occupation.
We've been listening to an interview with Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, from Nation Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the first movement of Schubert's Piano Sonata D960, performed by Alfred Brendel. Till next week, bye.